This is the Everything is a Primary Source podcast, where we arrive at the history of an era through its pop culture. Today's episode is the podcast equivalent of browsing a CD collection and seeing each disc as a document of the time period it was made in. Today's topic is Green Day's third studio album, Dookie, which was recorded in late 1993 and came out this month the following year. My guest for this episode, New England punk rocker Dave Strong, points to Dookie as a touchstone record as it opened up a new world of music for him. Add me and countless others to the list of teenagers of the time period who changed direction and musical tastes thanks to Green Day showing up in the mainstream. So we were chatting at the Rancid show, and I brought my stickers and my cards and stuff like that, and we exchanged information. And so I'm glad that we finally got this to work out, and just in time for the 30th anniversary of what you said is one of your favorite albums of all time, and that would be Green Day's Dookie. What's your connection with that album?
I don't know. I've got like a few sort of cool like memories of it. I know I'm pretty sure I was in eighth grade. Mm-hmm. Just 13, 14 years old, just kind of getting into rock and roll, not sure like who I was musically, but just picked up my first electric guitar, it was awesome. It was around the time when like Nirvana, like Nevermind was coming out, and mm-hmm. I had long hair at the time, but I was just kind of getting into myself, you know. I think before then, all I really listened to was like the Beatles and whatever was on the radio and stuff like that. But yeah, I mean, it just, that album itself was like, I think they played like When I Come Around and Basket Case at the school dances. Mm-hmm. They played California Sun by the Ramones version of California Sun at some of the dances. I heard that stuff. I was like, what is this? You know, this is what I love, you know, like I didn't know I loved it, but right. I loved it. Kind of took off.
You and I, that's like almost like a parallel, exactly the way I kind of met punk rock. And it's like almost word for word, because, and it's the same thing. I grew up listening to the Beatles because my parents were both huge Beatles fans, and the Beach Boys. And so it's like that kind of simple, straightforward rock and roll was like really in my head, and obviously informing my taste. I was really into like Aerosmith when I was probably like 12, 13 years old, right around the time that this came out. And I remember people talking about this band Green Day. I just get like kids are talking about it on the bus, and like they would sing the hidden track, I'm All By Myself. And I'm like, what is this group Green Day? They sound like, it's like the Jerky Boys. Like, are they weird? Like, you know, making prank calls. And then there's a song on the radio called like Mary May or something like, remember that one? Like, she sure liked the, it's a really bad song. I don't even know who did the song. I thought that was Green Day for the longest time. I didn't hear the DJ announce the song. So I'm like, well, this is probably those Green Day guys. It sounds, you know, and I had no idea. And then when I definitely did hear who they were, I think it was Basket Case was the first single that I got that direct connection. Like, this is Green Day. This is their song. I was like, yeah, this is good. I could like hear all those bands that I grew up listening to in their music. And I think that that's probably the first question that we could cover right now and talk about and see how this is like a real document of 1994 when the album came out, is what materials it made from. You're a songwriter, you're a musician. Yep. Where do you get your material for your music? What inspires you to write down lyrics and music?
A lot of the things in my life, like I'll draw a little bit of personal type stuff that from what I see on a daily basis or like what I've seen in the past, but then I'll kind of rewrite it in a way that it seems appealing to other people. Mm-hmm. You know, like I'll take somewhat of a real life story, but I'll change it to really awesome. You know what I'm saying? Like, and I'll kind of tell it in that type of person and like, you know, first person type way. That's what, how I've been drawing lately, at least.
Kind of like the Seinfeld of music. It's like relatable stuff. And yeah, it's catchy. And that's, isn't that where, like, there's so many like groups in that early 90s era. And I know I just made that remark about Seinfeld, but that's also the era of Seinfeld where people are writing about just ordinary things. Like when you think about all the tracks on Dookie, there, some of the topics are kind of big, like mental health, you know, is it one of the big car, but and then some of the songs are, and then the other songs deal with like feminism, you know, like she, but then other songs are just simple ordinary life stuff, you know, it just like Sassafras Roots is like, you know, I just want to waste time, you know, like it's, and there's a lot of groups doing that at simultaneously. If you go across the country, Green Day is in the East Bay. They're doing that kind of music. And they had been for a while. I mean, this is like several years into their career. This album comes out. Screeching Weasel in Chicago doing the same kind of music.
And Mike was in Screeching Weasel on like, on My Brain Hurts or How to Make Enemies? I think it was How to Make Enemies, that one. He plays bass on it.
Oh, really? I didn't know that. So he's part of that connection. Because I know that, I don't know if it's famous or not, but I always recognize when I watch their, when they did Woodstock 94, he's wearing the Screeching Weasel shirt on stage. And it's like showing that connection. Like we're doing the same thing. And then you go all the way to this area and you got the Queers doing same kind of thing where it's like very Ramones inspired, very Husker Du, Replacements-esque, but then you add into that the voice of young people in the 90s.
Yeah, and that's like the whole Lookout Records connection is what I know. It's like there was a studio called Sonic Iguana Studios. Mm-hmm. Mass did all the production there, and he recorded a ton of bands. I mean, he did like all the Screeching Weasel stuff. He did Kamen Rider, which was Jesse from Operation Ivy's band. And, you know, he did a lot of the Lookout Records stuff. And that's, I didn't even know when I heard Dookie that Green Day had two records before it. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know anything about Lookout Records. That took, I think I was in eighth grade. It took probably two or three more years before I started getting into real, real punk rock and pop punk, like the Queers mm-hmm. and Weasel per se, and the Groovy Ghoulies and stuff like that, before I even realized that that there was two more Green Day tapes. Because I went to Circuit City, I think, bought Dookie on tape. I still have it, I think, with the little Ernie on the back that they took away.
Yeah, they had to take that off, didn't they?
But I didn't know, like, I had no clue. I had to go back, and I bought Kerplunk, and I bought the Slappy Hours on the Slappy one.
Yeah.
And I was like, I had no clue. I mean,
now you're probably unable to buy those previous, like Kerplunk and Slappy Hours, you know, 39 Smooth Slappy Hours. Were you able to get those at Circuit City also, or are those only available at like your local stores?
No, I got both of those at Circuit City.
Wow.
I didn't know about them though. I didn't even think I saw them before Dookie came out. So I don't know if they like repressed them or if they, I don't know how that worked.
It's a good question. Or if they just like went back to the vault and be like, hey, we got a bunch of these laying around now that they're huge. Yeah. Let's bring them back out and get these going. Because I think that really kind of adds in, especially when it comes to, you know, how a group like this gets so big. Like I was mentioning before, Green Day's, they were at it since what, like 87, you know, and they had been working at it. And it's when you hear really any of their recorded stuff, you know, starting with 39 Smooth and then working your way up to Kerplunk and Dookie, they're pros. Like they're not amateurs, you know.
Wasn't Sweet Children or something was the band?
Yeah, Sweet Children was their name of their group. And I'm glad they changed their name because that doesn't quite, you know, I don't know if they would be the same group if they didn't have such a nice Green Day, you know, just like it's very easy to remember.
Yeah.
kind of thing. And that might even contribute to the material it's made from. You know, it's like easy to bill, easy to communicate, easy to request. I'm thinking like college radio stations probably had a lot to do with them getting some exposure early on, doing tours and stuff like that. So all of this builds into the material of that time period, that early 90s when Gen X is like at its height. I think you and I are about the same age. So we're like Xennials. We look up, we're older than millennials, but we're the youngest possible Gen Xers. So like I looked up to the Gen X people when I was a kid. My older brother, his friends, people older than that, I thought they were the coolest, you know, hanging out at coffee shops and like working at coffee shops and writing poetry on computers at coffee shops. You know, that was like their world, you know, and like the characters on Friends and stuff like that. That was like, wow, these people are cool. They have their, you know, Reality Bites. It's a cool movie. And, you know, it's like that was like Green Day and specifically Dookie is the soundtrack to that era. I've heard mentioned before about this particular album as kind of pulling us out of the Nirvana Seattle grunge quagmire. Personally, I'm not a big fan of the grunge stuff. That's just me, but
I like Nirvana a lot, but other than that, and I can deal with Pearl Jam and Soundgarden, but I never really dug into like too much of the early grunge. I'll put a play like a Sub Pop playlist on every now and then, but yeah, I'm glad too. It took a good direction, and Green Day had that like snotty type, I got something to say type punk rock attitude that really, I don't know. I needed it. I think I needed it. You know,
I think a lot of people did. And honestly, the lyrics or the themes to the songs more than anything else are not all that different from what you're getting from Seattle. You know, the Sub Pop groups, you know, the Pearl Jams and the Soundgardens and definitely not Nirvana. Like there's a lot of angst and depression, and but it's just delivered in such a different way. You know, Billy Joe's lyrics and the way he, like you said, that snotty sneering, awesome. Like just seeing Billy Joe like just doing, I don't know how he didn't break like all his strings all the time. You know, like when you play guitar, do you emulate like a style like his, like that really like pounding styles, you know, guitar strum, or do you have more of a Johnny Ramone style?
That's a good question. I actually think I might play more like Billy Joe. He does like couple down, a few up, couple down, a few up. I love his guitar too, by the way. He still plays that guitar, which is pretty crazy. It's like, I remember seeing I'm pretty sure it was the Woodstock thing. But I had to watch it again, like when it came out, you know, on like DVD and stuff. But I believe I had a recorder up against my TV in my bedroom. I had an 8-inch TV, and thank God it didn't would let me listen to the pay per view station, and but you couldn't see it. So I got all the audio off of it, and I was just like listening to it the whole time, and it was amazing. That like that shit is stuff I remember like for my whole life, you know.
I want to say that's the, obviously I didn't go to Woodstock 94, but it was that whole summer on MTV when they kept showing, yeah, they made music videos out of the live performances. And that's probably when I finally, like I was mentioning before, but like it didn't line up. Like I know of this group Green Day, I know these songs that might be theirs. Finally, they lined up, and I think it was that summer because I was finally got to see, and I'm like, oh, okay, I get it. And they, you know, they were throwing mud at the crowd and, you know, back and forth, that big mud fight and stuff.
I think that was their thing, sort of, because I went with, I can't remember if it was my aunt or my father, but it was definitely around September of 94. I want to say, don't quote me on the dates, but Green Day played at this place called the Hat Shell in Boston. And the free concert, they used to have free concerts there all the time. And they played like four songs in a mud and rock fight broke out.
Oh, geez.
And they kicked off the stage. It was like a little riot went on. There's tons of press about it. Now you can look it up now, I guess. But yeah, I was at that show and I was like, this is awesome, man. Or I even saw the Ramones. I mean, like, it changed my life. Like, I was like, this is what I want to do for the rest of my life. I want to be Green Day.
Well, I'm glad you brought up the Ramones connection again. I mean, we've been talking to Ramones. I mean, we have to, because that's no Ramones, no Green Day, no Ramones, no any of these groups. Even Pearl Jam, even Nirvana, you know, you don't have that. The door doesn't open for that other kinds of sounds without the Ramones. But I remarked one time, and I got a lot of crap for it, but I said Green Day has done more with that sound, like the bar chord, you know, the power chord, distorted guitar sound, than the Ramones ever did or wanted to do. And I always preface that by saying the Ramones are my favorite group of all time. They perfected rock and roll. But you cannot deny that Green Day has done more with that sound, because, I mean, just commercial success alone. By 1994, 2 years before the Ramones broke up for good, they were just selling platinum records. I mean, Dookie went, I don't know, multi-platinum probably, because they did it the right way at the right time for a wide audience. And I guess the Ramones, aside from South America, maybe Japan, they never had that kind of success.
They got famous more after the fact.
Yeah.
You know, they did do some like Lollapalooza stuff, you know, and then they did that, like, it was like Rancid and them at Lollapalooza in their last tour. And that they were starting to, I mean, they were already super famous by then, but like, I can kind of see where you got in hot water with that comment, but I also agree, because it's the generation that Green Day aims for, you know, like, it's just the way that it is. I mean, more eyes on them.
Exactly. And when the Ramones got inducted to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, it was Green Day that played their music. So it's like that connection was complete. I saw an interview recently. Yeah, I've been intentionally watching lots of stuff just to get ready for this. And they're interviewing Billy Joe, interviewing the whole band, asking who their influences are and who they like. And side note, they seem like the nicest guys. I've never met them. Obviously, I'd be talking about that right away if I ever met them. But they seem like really approachable guys. They seem pretty down to earth. And in this video from like the early 90s, before they really took off, they were just saying, listing off all their groups. And they include the Ramones in there. But they don't lead with that. They just say it because if you think about it, early 1990s, the Ramones hadn't quite reached that mythical status quite yet. That wouldn't come until after they broke up. And it was like that. And so to a group like Green Day, which are not a Ramones clone group, like they don't just, you know, there's really nothing about their look or even their sound that's like direct copy of the Ramones. They're just kind of like adding that into their basis. Like if anything, if I'm listening to Pulling Teeth off of Dookie, I hear the Beatles. Like, that's a Beatles song, you know? I'm all busted up, broken bones and nasty guts. And so it's like, they're just kind of like true Gen Xers, you know, children of the 70s, 60s, 70s. Like, they're born then, growing up in the 80s. They're just kind of like taking in all of these sounds, going in the direction that they like the most, which is the power pop punk rock type, you know, sneering, but still having fun. And I think that's what kind of sets them apart from the rest of that early 90s music, and that they're not just saying, all right, let's do the same thing the Ramones did 20 years ago. Like they're going off on their own tangent.
I totally agree. I've seen Green Day probably I don't know, probably like 15, 16 times. And I did see the Ramones one time, but they ended up opening for White Zombie. It was in 1987 in Lewiston, Maine. And honestly, I mean, there was more Green Day, like at all the shows that I've seen Green Day at, there was more show people at them, you know?
Yeah.
It's crazy. You're right, though. I think it is because of the time. It's definitely going to be because of the times. Because if the Ramones were around now, I think that they'd be selling out Coliseums too.
Yeah. And I think that because people would come around again and be like, oh, yeah, they are brilliant. Like, this is just perfect. We've been through the minutiae, all the rock and roll was in a pretty bad place in the early 2000s. And I think that's why the Ramones started to show up again on, you know, people's t-shirts and, you know, on pop radio, you'd hear, I Want to Be Sedated every now and then. You're like, people are like, oh yeah, I kind of wish we had taken care of that group a little bit more, because, you know, and Richie Ramone and Marky Ramone can still tour, just doing a whole set of Ramone songs, and they get a big crowd for it. I think people were looking for a new sound. They might have been getting a little bit tired with Kurt Cobain, you know, mumbling away. And it was like, hey, how about this? Here's this upbeat. You know, it's fast. It has a little bit more like happiness to it. Even if the songs are not actually about happy topics, it has like that just good rock and roll sound to it. And it's almost like Green Day saying, like, yeah, we've been here all along. It's just now the world's ready for us.
That is pretty much when I was, like, really getting into pop punk a lot. Like, I was going to, there was this place called the Elvis Room in Portsmouth. And the band The Queers, you know, they're from Portsmouth. They would play there. They would practice there sometimes, you know, a ton of free shows. And Joe would just bring... And he was on Lookout Records. So he would bring the Groovy Ghoulies, Mr. T Experience, Screeching Weasel, the Riverdales, which is pretty much Screeching Weasel. Just like every possible pop punk band you can think of made it through my small town that I lived in. So I was really, really getting into that like pop punk style. They call it like 27 style pop punk rock, you know? And it would, I mean, I loved it. I really loved it. So
no, I'm with you. I think it matched really well with the spirit of the youth of that generation. You know, it was like we were all kids of our parents grew up in the 60s. And so they got to that. And to me, the 60s is the best time for rock and roll. It's the most innovative time for rock and roll. And it's like like we started off on this podcast saying this, it was almost like they just kind of like, it was a trickle down effect. And when I was talking to Joe Queer for this podcast a few years ago, he put it so well. He's like, the 90s were like our 60s. It was like a repeat of the 60s, you know, handmade concert, you know, bills putting up, everybody had their own fanzine that you were making, and people were, you know, trading CDs with each other instead of records. Like, hey man, have you heard these guys? Oh yeah. You could borrow, make a tape out of this. Go ahead. You know, go home and make a tape out of this CD, and then, you know, trade that around. And, you know, it was super easy if you had a band to record a tape. All you needed was just a little tape deck and hit record and get some good stuff. It really just matches up with the time. We started off earlier saying how a very similar sound was coming out from all parts of the country, that, and in the East Coast, I think that the Queers were really the ones carrying that sound. There's other punk groups going on at the same time, but they're the ones who really had that Ramones-esque style about them. I heard yesterday, I was just on YouTube, and I came across a full set of the Queers at the 924 Gilman Street in Berkeley recording. So, and it was like, and they started off like the handbill, you know, that homemade handbill that says, you know, the Queers, says from Boston. But Joe starts the concert off by saying, "We're the Queers from Portsmouth, New Hampshire." And he's all the way out in San Francisco, right? He's out there. And it's like that was the scene that created Green Day. And by the mid 90s, these groups are just crisscrossing the country. They're similar. They're not the same, but they have such a similar sound. How does that happen? How do we get such similar sounds from these groups?
As far as, I mean, the Queers and Screeching Weasel, it's like they must have been like pen pals or something. I don't know. I'm just joking about that. But I know that Joe and Ben were really tight, you know? They like, and Screeching Weasel and the Queers, they kind of did, they would cover each other's songs, mm-hmm. you know, like Mirage and like Surf Goddess and Murder in the Brady House.
Yeah.
And all those songs.
Like a Parasite, yeah.
Like a Parasite, you know, they do each other's songs and stuff. And it's cool because Green Day, because Mike was in Screeching Weasel. So, I mean, you know, it's a small world, I guess is what I'm trying to say. You know, you never know how it works out. I remember the first time seeing Green Day on TV, I believe, was the MTV Jaded in Chicago thing. And Billy Joe was wearing a Pansy Division shirt. Mm-hmm. And they were doing, in the van, they were singing acoustically that song Groovy Underwear, which is a Pansy Division song. And, you know, I had never heard Pansy Division before, and I love Pansy Division. They like, just listening to Billy Joe and, like, because they always had pop punk, like, different shirts. Kind of like the you said earlier, like, different band shirts. And when I would see it, I'd check it out, and I'd be like, oh my God, this is so good. This is so freaking good. So
I think you're absolutely right. There's a culture, and it's also reflected in their guitars covered in stickers. And even if it wasn't intentional, there's like this subconscious way of like showing support for their overall. In other words, the scene had grown nationally. It, you know, you got the Muffs, you got the, like you mentioned before, the Mr. T Experience, you got, Cletus, and you know, all these groups up and down the East Coast, across I-90, you know, so it's like they're supporting each other. It's almost like there's a cycle when it comes to this, you know, pop music, and that, you know, maybe not exactly 30 years at a time, but you know, we've been talking about Dookie and how that was when that kind of underground punk rock type music was cresting a wave, and then it just kind of splashed down again. And now it's 30 years later, it's rising back up again. And maybe this is just the way it's going to be from here on out, that we're just going to get these good times and bad times when it comes to original music. And the sounds that are coming out now, would you say that it's remarkably different from, say, Green Day circa 1994? Or do they still seem to have a good like foot in that realm, but are trying something new with the other side?
As far as my music, I would say it's staying pretty true to the 90s. I haven't really stemmed too far off, but there's a few bands that I've seen that are doing their own thing. Like, ska's coming back. There's a lot of ska that I've seen lately.
That's gonna be fun.
Yeah, yeah, and they're doing great. I mean, there's a band called 13 Cavities from Philly, and you know, they killed it at the show that I went to. That, I mean, they played with me, and it was amazing. Like, they're great. They actually just got a record, or it's coming out on Fameless Records too. I'm really stoked to be on this label. I'm like totally pumped the way that everything's coming up.
I'm glad to hear all this, because to get back to our conversation, and we left off talking about the locations of it, and the 924 Gilman Street Alternative Music Foundation in Berkeley, California, the Gilman, as they call it, which is the hub of all this underground music from the East Bay or from just the general Bay Area in California, Northern California, where Operation Ivy and The Offspring and AFI and Rancid and Green Day all really became known entities. And the club itself was unique in that it wasn't just an all-out punk moshing extravaganza. They had rules. It was like a collective that you couldn't just, you know, it was almost like a co-op in a way, where, you know, you had to make sure that, you know, so the police wouldn't shut you down, right? And honestly, just side note, that's what I love about punk rock. Like, I've done a few other styles of music on this podcast, but the reason I always go back to punk rock is because it's so democratic. It's so anybody can do it and do it well. That takes people such as yourself with, you know, that next level of talent and tenacity for it. But I've been to so many shows where you're in the crowd and you're looking at the person next to you and they're like the singer for the next band that's up there. You know, there's no rock stars. There's nobody like, you know, hanging around and be like, get me another glass of wine. As I, you know, it's nothing like that. It's every, you know, they're back at their, like, I've met Joe Queer a couple times at merch tables. You know, he's selling his own t-shirts. He's not, you know, having, you know, some like model, like light a cigarette for him or something like that.
He's really good. He's good at that. He's good with that.
And he knows how to treat his audience. And yeah. I feel like there was a lot of that going on in the 1990s. And Gilman represented that in Northern California. But they banned Green Day after they came out with Dookie. They felt that, and I don't know exactly how, if there was a lot of like teeth behind that, if they were, you know, if it was like a throwdown kind of thing, or if it was just kind of like, well, you've made it huge, there's the door. We don't, you know, you shouldn't be playing at this venue anymore because this is meant for local acts to really get known or underground acts to get known. But they weren't able to play there until 2015. It was not until 2015 that they returned, and Jello Biafra, actually, of the Dead Kennedys, is the one that introduced them back to the stage in 2015.
Really?
Yeah, it was. I just watched that again yesterday. I'm not like sitting on this wealth of knowledge. I've been perusing YouTube a lot lately. The three of the four singles that were released to support the album,
yeah.
I think Longview was the first one, actually, which is interesting because that's unlike the other ones by quite a bit. I mean, it's very bass heavy, which I really, that style of bass that Mike Dirnt plays is so California.
I mean, it was the first one I ever learned on bass. There's so much first for this, like. When I come around, it was one of like the first songs I ever learned on guitar. Longview was like one of the first songs I ever learned on bass. It was just like so much.
Do you think that was, I mean, speaking of the behavior and ideas, I think there's probably the difference between their skill, their ability as musicians is not light years beyond the listener, that the listener could easily pick up a guitar. Do you think that they even want that? They're encouraging that. They want kids, teenagers, and young adults to grab a guitar and play along with their music.
Well, I love that Billy Joe gives a guitar to a kid at every show. That's amazing right off the bat. The fact that he can like use a celebrity to like give away shit like that, pull up a young kid and give them a guitar. It just like makes someone's day every day. That's so friggin' awesome. I don't even know if they knew that they were going to be so big when Dookie came out, you know, like, cause I have the demos record and I mean, obviously they knew that it was going to come out on Warner Brothers, but like, who would have known? Who would have known that it was going to blow up like that? You know,
I think it just is symptomatic of the era. It really just comes down to that, 94, that was a big year for I think just a lot of things. I mean, we were out of the Cold War. You know, there wasn't that anymore. We, you know, the Gulf War is behind us. We're into the Clinton years. The internet was about to really explode with everybody. If anything, the cover art for Dookie, it kind of maybe even hints at that. Yeah, they knew. I mean, they didn't design the cover art. A friend of theirs did, but it's like they knew that this was going to make a explosion in the time that it was. If it had come out 2 years earlier, probably would have not performed nearly as well, or, you know, a couple years later, it would have just gotten mixed up with the other groups that were showing up on the spectrum of musicians. But coming out right there in 19, you know, they recorded this late 1993, put it out early 1994. It's like just the timing says so much that the world was like ready for it at that time. 17 and strung out on confusion. Tried to design a robot person. When you started playing your guitar, did you go to like Daddy's Junkie Music and get your first guitar, like, or did you buy it brand new?
No, I went to Daddy's Junkie Music. I think before then I had like, there used to be a store called Richards or something. I think it was, it was like a, I don't know. It might be Big Lots now, but like,
yeah. I remember Richards.
Yeah.
I got locked in the bathroom at Richards when I was like 6 years old.
That's traumatizing.
And it was.
You could do a whole podcast on that one.
I should. I can't get out.
I got one of those guitars that like, it was a cheap electric guitar with like a battery backup with like a little speaker in it from then. But then after I pretty much broke it, I did. I went to Daddy's Junkie Music and I believe I got like it was a PV style Strat. I got the whole, I think I got like a PV Bandit amp or something with it, like a teeny one. Mm-hmm. And it was the whole PV setup, you know, it was great. It was like a fake Strat and I loved it.
Cause like you go ahead to another time period. And I mean, Daddy's is a New England chain. For those of you listening outside of New England, it started in Boston and spread throughout New England. And it was started by Fred Bramante, who specifically, he's actually been on the show, who specifically wanted to allow artists to exchange their musical instruments. And it went out of business in 2007, which I think is just the right time for something like that to fade away, because by 2007, we're on to Rock Band. You know, we were entering a recession, so there wasn't a lot of money being thrown around anyway. But you go back in time 20 years before that, you know, 1987 through the early 2000s, early 90s, that is just the time for people saying, I want to start a band. I mean, when you were in high school, how many bands were in your school just made up of kids? Probably more than a few, right?
Yeah, there was a few.
And groups like Green Day factored into that inspiration. Like, I remember just categorizing all the different groups in our school. Like, the band I was in, and we were in the, you know, Northern Adirondacks of New York, so it wasn't exactly punk rock central. But I think we would be closest compared, if you were in comparison to what was on the radio, it'd be like a Green Day type group, you know, very just pop punk, you know, style music that we were playing. And then we had like a hippie band in our school, and then other kids just like did Korn covers. And, you know, it's just like, but even if the music wasn't necessarily your forte, the fact that they were making it themselves and not just consuming it, I think is so reflective of the time period of, all right, this is on MTV. I want to be like that. Now, if I'm watching MTV, some of the artists I can't replicate, you know, yeah. It's like if you're a vocal artist, or if you're, you know, if you're have like 25 backup dancers and you're doing all this stuff. But if it's three guys, a guitar, a bass, and a drummer, I can at least attempt it. You know, I might not be as good as Green Day, but I can at least say, yeah, I could do that too. And I'm going to go, you know, I don't even know where you'd go for used equipment anymore. I mean, you have Guitar Center, but that's kind of corporate-y. You know, it's really not, it's not the same culture that used to exist of, you know, these, I remember the place I got my first bass was you know, it smelled like cigarettes, and it was just like, you know, these old musician guys, they knew what they're doing. And they'd be like, I think I'll start you off on this Epiphone over here. That'll be good for you. It's only 100, you know, you put it on layaway or something. And you know what I mean? It's like, it's like it's an era.
I go to, my buddy Ralph. He has a place called Ralph's House of Tone. There used to be a place called Aircraft
in Dover. Yeah.
And Ralph was right beside them for a while. And I actually like rented like a saxophone from him one year for my daughter's school. And he's still in Dover, but he moved to a smaller place. That's where I go to get all my guitars serviced and like anything that I need music. I go to Ralph's, but there's a place in Portsmouth, that I know, I think it's called Gary's Guitar.
Mm-hmm.
But like Joe King goes and all, like a lot of the Portsmouth rock star type people, you know. It's a small ass store that I think they're like a Gretsch dealer and a Fender dealer now, but they've been there forever. So as long as I can remember, they've been there too. So it was like, that's another thing about the connection with Green Day. It's like, you know, the Gilman Street thing, they had Larry Livermore, who had Lookout Records, was in a band with Trey called the Lookouts before, I'm pretty sure before he was even in Green Day. And then you had the Screeching Weasel, and then I don't know what Billy Joe was in before, if he was in anything, but
he played with, well, it was after Green Day had started, but he actually was going to be in Rancid for a little while. And he co-wrote the song Radio,
really,
by Rancid. And just, that's a funny one because I love Rancid. I mean, that's why we're at that concert together.
Yeah.
But it's funny how those two groups, I remember playing Operation Ivy for somebody one time, and they're like, this sounds like Green Day. I'm like, well, same scene. You know, it's like, they don't actually sound like Green Day, but it's, and no. Green Day would play Operation Ivy. They play Knowledge, I think, is the one that they do.
Yep.
Sometimes they cover it. But it's like, you have groups that sound remarkably different, look remarkably different. I think we can, you know, finish talking about the look of Green Day. They've been through a lot of different looks, but you compare them with Rancid. Rancid is very much like early 80s, almost London, you know, with the mohawks and the leather, studded leather jackets, you know, covered in patches, and the bondage pants and the Doc Martens and everything. Then you have Green Day, t-shirts and jeans, you know, at least in that era, sometimes even wearing like dresses on stage, and, you know, kind of being weird and subversive. Okay. A little bit.
That kind of goes back to the grungy thing, because he does wear dresses, and he used to, at least sometimes on stage.
And I think sometimes the visual aspect of Green Day, you see like a poster or something with them dressed funny and stuff, didn't really always match up with the sound. You know, like when you hear that sound, you're like, oh yeah, punk rock. But then when you see them, and then, you know, late 90s Green Day, they start wearing like the real tight jeans, and, you know, by the time you get to American Idiot, they're doing the eyeliner thing, so it was real popular in the early 2000s. And their look has changed. But to just bring it back to the era of Dookie, they weren't dressed like Rancid. They weren't dressed with the big hawks and, you know, doing that kind of thing. They were just regular guys. And I think that's what I really love about that era of punk, where it was like just ordinary guys picking up guitars, just playing the music they want to hear because they can't get it anywhere else. So like, I'm going to make the music. If I can't get it myself, I'll make it, you know? That is just so reflective of the era. And we could go on and on just about how great this album is, but you mentioned your favorite songs. Let's go through just real quick a list of deep cuts off of Dookie that you think that you know the top four are the ones that were released. You know, you have Basket Case, you have Welcome to Paradise, Longview, and When I Come Around.
Yeah.
off of that list, what are your top songs from Dookie?
Off of the four you just said, or other
yeah,
ones?
No, aside from those four.
Aside from those, so I would probably say Enema Sleepus is my favorite. Chump, I really like. Well, she kind of has gotten some radio hits too.
Yeah, that's I think after probably after the album had been around for a while, that started showing up sometimes.
But FOD, I really love FOD a lot. Those are probably my three favorite on the album for sure.
I like Pulling Teeth.
Yeah,
that's a big one for me. I like Sassafras Root. And I had, maybe I'll go back to that list. I feel bad, but When I Come Around is probably my all time favorite Green Day song.
Very influential. It's tough to because it gets played everywhere. That's the only, and I'm not like that type of person that like hates on something because it's overplayed. So I don't want to go down that road. But sometimes when I'm in my car and it comes on, I'll skip it because I'll be like, oh, what's next? But
right.
You're right. I really love that song. It was probably the most influential on that album. I agree with you.
It doesn't take away from the song, but it does definitely make it less powerful if you hear it at least once a day.
Yeah.
You know, I think we're in agreement on that.
Yep.
This is, I don't think if this album had been as successful as it was, I don't think we would get the Green Day that eventually is, you know, playing this huge concert tour this summer in support of, you know, they wouldn't be celebrating 30th anniversary of an album that, you know, but it's just like it hit the right time, the right place, the right interest. It says so much about 1994. And Dave Strong, I really appreciate you taking the time with me today to talk about one of our shared favorites.
This was awesome. Thank you for having me, man.
And everybody, where can they find you easiest online?
So online, on Spotify, Apple Music, you know, any of the streaming platforms, you can look up Dave Strong. And right now there's 16 songs streaming. So, you know, you can get, I'm in YouTube, Amazon, pretty much anywhere you listen to music, you know, you can find me.
And you got some cool covers on your album, right? Yeah, a Ramones song and an Eddie Cochran. And yeah. I mean, that's the beauty of this kind of music is that, you know, the punk rock stuff is that it's so deeply rooted in the early rock and roll that when you hear Eddie Cochran and even some of the early Beatles stuff, you're like, yeah, I've heard that already, but just in, you know, embedded in the music that I love from, in this case, 1994. Thank you again for listening to the EPS podcast, where everything, including Green Day's Dookie, is a primary source. Please rate and follow this podcast wherever you are listening to it right now, and share it with everyone you know. You can follow the Everything is a Primary Source podcast on social media, including YouTube and especially Instagram. Show notes, which expound on each episode and essays about history and pop culture, can be found on Substack. The hub for all these things is everything-history.com. Thank you for listening to the EPS podcast, where everything is a primary source.